Good evening, I'm John Yang. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, a speaker at last. After 15 votes, key concessions, and even physical altercations, Republican Kevin McCarthy is the new Speaker of the House. Then recovery efforts in Pakistan after last year's devastating floods. Officials warn aid is running out and the need is dire.
We're trying our best to manage the situation. We have mobilized all our resources, but we need the help of the international community.
And dry January, a look at the growing trend of a month without alcohol after the excesses of the holiday season. Good evening. There is finally a Speaker of the House of Representatives. After 4 days of defeats and deal-making, Republican Kevin McCarthy was elected to the job early this morning on the 15th try. That's the most since before the Civil War.
So help you God.
Yes, I do.
Congratulations and Godspeed.
His victory came during a dramatic and sometimes rancorous session.
Jeffries.
After he fell one vote short on the 14th try, McCarthy confronted holdouts Matt Gaetz of Florida and Lauren Boebert of Colorado. Tempers flared. At one point, McCarthy supporter Mike Rogers of Alabama had to be restrained. After winning the post that had eluded him for years, McCarthy outlined a conservative agenda that included investigations of the Biden administration.
We will hold the swamp accountable. From the withdrawal of Afghanistan to the origins of COVID and to the weaponization of the FBI. Let me be very clear. We will use the power of the purse and the power of the subpoena to get the job done.
Later, he credited a key backer for helping him get across the finish line.
I do want to especially thank President Trump. I don't think anybody should doubt his influence.
All members elect will raise their right hand.
The election of a speaker cleared the way to formally assemble the 118th Congress as House members took the oath of office.
Congratulations. You are now members of the 118th Congress.
McCarthy's victory came after a series of concessions that give hardline conservatives greater influence in the House, notably on spending and tax bills. What did McCarthy's prolonged battle and the deals he cut mean for his leadership, for the House, and for the governing of the nation? Sarah Binder is a George Washington University political scientist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sarah, one of the things that that Speaker McCarthy said last night is what we do here today, next week, next month, and next year will set the tone for everything that follows. What tone was set by what happened this week?
Well, what we watched play out in front of us in levels of detail we're not usually accustomed to on C-SPAN was a very slim, fractured majority trying to get on the same page. And what we saw was the speaker-to-be, in doubt at times, trying to figure out how much could he give away to his opponents and would they take it? Would they take these concessions that they were demanding and then give him his votes? We'll see those fractures emerge throughout this coming Congress, for sure.
In what ways? Look ahead, and in what ways are we going to see those fractures?
So one of the core issues that divides the holdouts from Speaker McCarthy is the question about the federal budget, federal deficits, and federal debt. And there are two things this Congress, like most Congresses, will have to do. At some point, mostly in the fall, they will need to pass spending bills, get them through the House, the Senate, and the White House, pass spending bills that most recently raise federal spending, both for domestic side and defense side. But his opponents have vowed not to do that. They want to cut. They want to cut both defense spending, which the defense hawks in the Republican Party aren't going to want to do, and they're going to want to severely cut domestic spending And it's not clear that 218 Republicans even, especially those from swing districts won by President Biden, it's not clear they're going to go along. So how do you keep the government funded and open? Will there be a government shutdown?
Do you think any of these concessions may come back to haunt him?
Well, I think the key concessions here, first of all, are Speaker McCarthy's willingness and his agreement to put three Freedom Caucus members from the far right of the conference, to put them on the Rules Committee, which is an arm of the Republican leadership. That's the committee that decides which bills would go to the floor, under what conditions, will there be amendments, who will offer the amendments. With three Freedom Caucus members on that committee, is going to put them in a position to try to advance their policies, not just to block things on the floor that they've sort of mastered in the past. I think that could come back to haunt Speaker McCarthy. Others will point to this motion to vacate the speakership. That's existed in the past. I think McCarthy, it's a thin reed that he's standing on already, and that threat of deposing him, it's going to be put a little more oomph behind those threats.
You talk about a slim, fractured majority. I mean, the fact that it was just really about 20 members that tied the House up in knots, are we going to see more of that?
McCarthy comes into the speakership, by all accounts, quite weakened by what he's given away. And I think that's going to encourage not just the original five holdouts and not merely the 20 who secured some concessions in this deal-making over the speakership. I think that will encourage other members of the Republican majority to come forward and to push their perspectives as well. Right? Think about those, you know, one and a half, there's about 18 members who are elected in districts that President Biden won. Those folks aren't going to be that happy lining up behind the agenda of the Freedom Caucus. And that's trouble ahead. That's really trouble ahead for Speaker McCarthy.
Sarah Binder of George Washington University and the Brookings Institution, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
There is other news today. Fighting went on in eastern Ukraine despite Russia declaring a ceasefire in observance of Eastern Orthodox Christmas. Shelling reduced entire city blocks in the town of Bakhmut to rubble. Ukraine called Russian President Vladimir Putin's 36-hour ceasefire a ploy. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky praised the latest multi-billion-dollar package of U.S. military assistance.
This is exactly what is needed. New guns and rounds, including high-precision ones. New rockets, new drones. It is timely and strong.
The latest aid package is over $3 billion, the largest yet. In Newport News, Virginia, the mayor says that a first-grade teacher's condition is improving after a six-year-old student shot and critically injured her yesterday in the classroom. Police say the boy was part of an altercation and that the shooting was intentional. No one else was injured. A school shooting involving a child this young is rare. Virginia law limits the ways a child can be punished for a crime like this. Federal appeals court in New Orleans has struck down a ban on so-called bump stocks, the device that helps fire multiple rounds from semi-automatic guns. The Trump administration banned bump stocks after the 2017 massacre at a Las Vegas music concert, the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. The court ruling has no immediate effect. It sends the case back to a lower court for further consideration. And a new COVID strain of Omicron is on the rise across the nation, partly, health officials say, because of holiday gatherings. XBB 1.5 accounts for almost 28% of the cases nationwide. It's more transmissible than other strains, but it's not clear yet whether it causes worse outcomes. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, an update on humanitarian relief efforts in Pakistan from last year's floods. And no alcohol trend known as Dry January.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Months after devastating floods left more than 1,700 people dead and a third of the country underwater, Pakistan is still struggling to recover. UN officials warn that millions remain displaced from their homes and livelihoods as winter sets in. The crisis, they say, will only deepen without more help. NewsHour special correspondent Fred de San Lazaro reports on the desperate conditions in hard-hit Sindh province. His reporting was produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center.
The monsoon rains last year were like nothing anyone had seen before.
The water came and swept away our houses. We need help.
An early spring ushered in a record-breaking heat wave. In some areas, temperatures topped 123 degrees. Warming global temperatures have also fueled unprecedented glacial melt that has swelled rivers. And when the record-setting monsoon arrived, it dropped nearly twice as much rain as the 30-year average across the country.
I don't have anything to feed my family. I lost everything.
The violent swells swept away hundreds of thousands of homes and obliterated hospitals, schools, and major infrastructure.
It's been leveled out, everything. We've had a huge number of dams which broke down, which did not sustain the flow of water. Road networks, hundreds of kilometers of roads have been wiped out.
So you've seen a lot of change here.
Scientists and environmental activists like Tofiq Pasha Muraj, who's worked with the NewsHour on our reporting trips to Pakistan, point to climate change as another factor.
Things have gone totally out of sync. Our winters have become shorter. Summers, therefore, have become much broader, hotter. The rains have been more severe. We have major issues with growing our crops.
5 months since the floods, the water remains. Pakistan has made only scant contributions to carbon dioxide emissions, but this nation is one of the world's most vulnerable to climate extremes. Pakistan led the way at the UN Climate Conference, COP27, last November, pushing for the Loss and Damage Fund to help developing nations cope. The cash-strapped government was already facing a serious financial crisis before the floods, which caused an estimated $40 billion in damage.
Let us all step up in solidarity and support to the people of Pakistan in their hour of need.
But by last month, the UN was only able to raise about a third of the $816 million it sought for relief.
Who helps the poor? Everyone comes, takes pictures, and goes.
And the UN's World Food Program, which serves some 2.7 million Pakistanis, says it will run out of funds in the next few weeks. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Fred de San Lazaro in Sindh Province, Pakistan.
On Monday, the United Nations and Pakistan are to host a one-day international conference in Geneva with the goal of raising about half the $16 billion needed to help survivors and to rebuild. Masood Khan is Pakistan's ambassador to the United States. Mr. Khan, thank you very much for joining us. How dire is the need right now in Pakistan? Give us we saw some of the pictures, but how bad is the need?
The situation is very bad. As a matter of fact, I mean, there's a misperception that the two phases of relief and recovery are over. They aren't over. I mean, we need immediate humanitarian assistance, but we also need dire assistance for rehabilitation and reconstruction. So this was the worst climate disaster in Pakistan and one of the worst climate disasters in the world. So we are living with the consequences of that climate-induced disaster, and we need the help of the international community. Their needs are dire.
We heard the woman in the tape say that everyone comes, takes pictures, and goes. Do you feel that the global community has moved on, has forgotten about what the situation is?
Yes, the world community's attention was at its peak in September or October 2022. But then the attention of the world community, world leaders were diverted. I mean, there's Ukraine, there's attention to the Asia-Pacific region. There are disasters around the world. And there's also this short attention span in the media. We are trying our best to manage the situation. We have mobilized all our resources, but we need the help of the international community, particularly for this year.
We've seen stories coming out of Islamabad that government officials of your government say that they're concerned that this funding conference on Monday will fall short. Why is that?
Well, one is donor fatigue, as a matter of fact, and there are many competing priorities. The other thing is that the world has seen many crises. For instance, there was the COVID-19 pandemic, followed by fuel and food hyperinflation all over the world. But still, we are hoping that under the leadership of the United Nations, United Nations Secretary General, with the convening power of states like the United States, we would be able to get some support. You know, these pledges that are made at the conferences, they do not materialize speedily. That's one of the problems. So we hope that this time we would be able to get pledges for the bulk of the requirements or needs that we have for rehabilitation, reconstruction. And we need this assistance in the next 3 years to build our infrastructure, climate resilient infrastructure, and to preserve what we already have.
How satisfied are you with the U.S. response? Not only what the U.S. is doing itself, but sort of galvanizing support around the world?
Well, we're grateful to the United States for giving a very generous and prompt response to the humanitarian needs in the initial phase of relief and recovery. They contributed about $97 million within a span of a few weeks. And then the American citizenry was very helpful. I mean, they stepped forward, responded to the climate disaster in Pakistan. Now, the United States has three roles, basically. One is its direct contribution. We hope that they would be able to make that and announce a substantial contribution to our endeavor in Geneva. Second is their convening power with other governments and with the international financial institutions, because the United States has influence all over the world. And the third is that it would be a partner in our climate resilient efforts.
We noted in the piece also that Pakistan was one of the leaders in pushing at the recent climate conference for the establishment of the Loss and Damage Fund to help mitigate the damages that smaller nations are suffering from the greenhouse gas outputs of the richer and more industrialized nations. There have been similar pledges that didn't materialize. How confident are you that this one is going to play out?
Well, let's remain hopeful. I mean, the first barrier has been removed. We have made a decision, I mean, the international community has made a decision to create this loss and damage fund. This is an achievement in itself, but the fund itself has to be funded. I mean, you need to raise finances. And you have to persuade all the governments, the rich governments, the governments which are prospering because of the use of fossil fuels and so on. And then the real objective is to help the vulnerable countries like Pakistan to transition to move away from fossil fuels and invest in clean energy. I mean, these are the objectives. So we will have to repurpose international community's resources to support this fund.
Pakistani Ambassador Masood Khan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure to talk to you.
Weekends are generally a time for being with friends and perhaps enjoying an adult beverage. But a growing number of people are going without alcohol this month, taking a break from the indulgences of the holiday season. They're participating in what's known as Dry January. Dr. Ratanya Kaur is head of gastroenterology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Dr. Kaur, why is this idea about Dry January so popular?
Well, first, thank you for having me on, and thank you for sharing this story, because one of the goals of this month is really to reduce the stigma around those who overconsume alcohol. But it's so popular. Actually, my city, I think, gets to take a little bit of credit for that. This concept of Dry January has been around since the 1940s, and a Seattle reporter wrote about it in the Seattle Times, and it seems like after that, the concept really took off. And now internationally, various countries are really getting the word out about Dry January and encouraging their citizens to participate. And I think it's because we have linked it to a bit of a social opportunity for the month of January. So coming off of the holidays, everyone can really get into doing something together in the name of their own health.
Are there health benefits of this, of even just not having a drink for just 1 month?
Absolutely. You know, the first thing that people will say is that they just feel better. It's just a general feeling, and there's no other description besides that. And we, as physicians, as other medical providers, also notice that there are improvements in cholesterol level and sugar levels, blood pressure levels. And as a liver doctor myself, even those liver blood tests will improve in just a month of sobriety from alcohol.
Now, I know you've tried this with your family. What tips do you have from that experience for people who want to try this?
Well, the first thing is to indeed get your crew, whether it's family, friends, some of the online communities. Thinking ahead of January and deciding who you want to do this with. I think there's a lot of success that way. And checking in, making sure that, you know, you're keeping each other honest, on track, making a plan for what you're going to drink if you do indeed go out to social events where there's going to be alcohol. And it's really been very supportive and fun for my cousins and me to participate in.
You talked about the social pressures. I mean, do you find when you were doing it, did you find that people who were not doing it, who were drinking, were uncomfortable knowing that you weren't drinking?
No. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Most people wanted to know in advance so that they wouldn't put me in the position of needing to make a decision about drinking or not. I really have not found any problems. So I do encourage people to just say what they're doing, and I'm sure their social networks will be very, very supportive.
Is this for everybody?
This is not for everyone. I would say that for the majority of people who are drinking low to upwards of moderate level of alcohol, it is a very safe thing to do. But for people who have higher levels of intake, and by the way, it doesn't take much to reach that threshold for the average male. It's 2 drinks or more a day, and for the average female, it's, you know, just more than 1 drink a day. But for people who have that kind of alcohol intake, I do recommend first talking with your provider to plan a reduction in alcohol intake, because if you do stop cold turkey, it could lead to significant health problems like alcohol withdrawal.
You talked about the health benefits, and is a 1 month enough time to get those health benefits?
Absolutely. And you know what is even more remarkable, which probably surprised most of us? For people who participate in Dry January for the 31 days of January, when we ask them 6 months out, a year out, they are still having health benefits. Most people will report that they have continued to either not drink or reduce their alcohol consumption even after months out. We all should be mindful of our alcohol intake, and we all should aim to reduce our consumption. Alcohol is a class 1 carcinogen. It is really important now that we reduce the stigma, talk about it, educate, and participating in Dry January is one really great way to jumpstart that behavior.
Dr. Ratanya Kaur, the University of Washington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. on Sunday, the latest on the Biden administration's immigration reform plans with the president's visit to the Texas-Mexico border. I'm John Yang. For all my colleagues, thanks. See you tomorrow.